1981 was one of the worst years for violence in the Northern Troubles, as my next guest knows only too well.
And now you see policeman has been killed and another critically injured in a rocket attack in Suffolk Street in Belfast. Here's Pauline Huron of our Northern staff.
The police Land Rover was travelling along the Glen Road end of the Suffolk Road in southwest Belfast when it came under attack by a rocket from a nearby housing estate. Two RUC men were rushed to hospital and one of them died almost immediately. The side was ripped out of the Land Rover and the second man is still seriously ill.
Well, the RUC man critically injured in that attack did survive, although the attack changed his life in many ways. He's in our Belfast studio now. Michael Patterson, good morning to you.
Good morning, Catherine.
First of all, had you heard that clip before, actually?
No, that's the first time, actually. And it seemed kind of strange listening to it and knowing it was speaking about me and Alec Beck, who was killed.
Mm. Tell me a little bit about your life before the incident in September 81.
Well, in September 81, I'd been 24 years old. I'd been married for 3 weeks and 2.5 years service in the police. And I had a promising career ahead of me because I'd been doing rather well in the monthly probationary exams in the previous 2 years. So I was looking forward to a long and enjoyable career.
So take me back to the morning of the attack that we heard just there. Describe what you remember.
Well, that particular morning, it was my wife's birthday, and I'd got up, and if you'd been a fly on the wall, you would have seen me just giving her a gentle kiss on the forehead and touching her cheek with my hand, with the back of my hand, and not realising then it was for the last time I would ever do that. And went on to work. We'd been on mobile patrol. It was a lovely autumnal morning, sun was shining, it was pleasantly warm, and we're chatting away and in the police vehicle, and I was saying that I was making a meal for my wife that night, and there's a bit of banter going on from the other guys about, oh yes, you're just after one thing, that sort of chat. But anyway, I was aware of an explosion out to the left-hand side of our vehicle, and my first thought was, it's a blast bomb, but we're okay in here. And then I was aware of the two-tone horns sounding, and they were just going, nee-no, nee-no. And I wanted to switch out and or reach out and switch them off, but I couldn't. And then I looked down and I saw that my right arm was severed. I could see the strands of flesh just hanging. And there was a certain eeriness and fuzziness to the image that I could see. I looked across and saw Alec Beck slumped over. And my thought was, Alec's dead. And I think he probably was at that stage. I then looked down and saw my left leg, the femur, was smashed, and turned round. Phil, who was in the back, he was just sitting there staring. And it seemed like a long, long time before anything happened. Then some army medics came and they dressed up the wounds. The ambulance crew came and they got me out. But what had happened in between the time, in what seemed that long period, was we were being shot at the same time, because the second Land Rover that was in the patrol, I was told afterwards that the idea was that as they jumped out, then the gun team, who was with the rocket team that had fired the rocket-propelled grenade, that they were trying to kill the officers that got out of the second vehicle. But they sat tight and didn't get out, so it was just a bit of smart thinking on their part. So eventually I got to the Royal Victoria Hospital.
And can I just ask you, were you conscious throughout this whole time?
I was, and very aware of what was going on, and I knew I had lost my arms at that point. And whenever I got to the Royal Victoria, there was a lot of activity, and I was saying, could somebody phone my wife? And it seemed a rather strange thing to say, because I wasn't really used to the fact I was married. It was only 3 weeks, and I was being ignored. So I started to get quite annoyed. I said, would somebody phone my wife? I still ignored. Would somebody phone my wife? And a nurse said, I'll do it. Now, I should have known. Some of my police colleagues would have done it for me.
Mm.
But the nurse said she would do it. And then I was comfortable with that. Then I slipped into unconsciousness. It could have been I was being given morphine at that point. The next thing that I was consciously aware of was opening my eyes that night in intensive care, and my family were around me. And what had happened between then and that evening was I'd actually died for a while. and it had a what's called a death experience. Some people who have had a near-death experience would talk about being in a dark tunnel with the light at the end of it. Mm-hmm. But I was actually in the light and had what I would describe as like ghostly shapes around me, but feeling very much at peace, very comfortable, but a sense of this isn't really my time. I could have stayed comfortably, but I came back.
And did you remember that from the moment that you woke up? Did you remember being in that light?
As I described to my mother's aunt, I felt close to God. And it wasn't in a sort of Christian sense or anything like that. It was a very spiritual experience. And so I was aware of that. And it was only a number of years later when I'd read about the near-death experience in a psychology textbook that I thought to myself, that's what I was in.
Did the hospital tell you that you had technically died?
No, they did not. It was many years later. I was speaking to the surgeon and Professor Rob Mullen, and I asked him, well, tell me this, Rob, that whenever you were working on me that day, did I die? He says, why do you ask? Now, he was always very careful not to upset people. So I explained to him, and he says, well, you did, but obviously we got you back. So I was certainly aware of that experience.
But he only told you that years later?
Well, he confirmed it for me years later. But if I hadn't asked, nobody would have told me.
Wow. Uh-huh. Tell me then about, so when you did come round, when you did wake up, your family's visit to the bedside.
Oh,
that
yes.
was quite awkward.
It certainly was, Catherine. When I opened my eyes, I knew I'd lost my arms, but I didn't know that they knew. So a bit of a dance took place.
Who was around the bed?
It was my mum, my dad and Hazel, my wife. There was somebody else in the background, but I can't remember who it was just at that moment. But I said to Hazel, were you speaking to the doctor? She says, I was. What did he say about me? He says, well, you're a bit cut up, but you're going to be okay. Right. My thought was, they don't know. So
everyone was avoiding the elephant in the room.
Absolutely. And then I asked, well, did he say anything about my arms? He said they're a bit cut up, but you're going to be okay. I said, she doesn't know. Hazel, do you know I've lost my arms? I do. That's okay then. So that got the issue sorted, and I was quite euphoric and quite in good form. And it probably had a lot to do with the morphine that was in my system at that point. Mm.
But I mean, such a transformation to happen 3 weeks into your marriage. And we'll talk about the psychological trauma that you suffered. But I mean, what was that like adapting to life without arms or hands? And I can only imagine for Hazel, you know, you're married for the couple of weeks and you're used to your husband's arms being around you. Very difficult for her.
It certainly was, because I was in hospital for 3 months and her father was ill at the same time in a different hospital. I was in the Royal Victoria. He was in Belfast City, which is really, as the crow flies, about a mile. Mm. But she went from seeing me to seeing him, and then he died a month later at the end of October. So she wasn't really able to grieve, because it was a case of coming up to see me after work and going home, sleeping, going to work, coming to see me. And it was only after I got out of hospital that she started to do her grieving.
Mm. How did it affect your marriage?
It's an interesting one, because I had nothing really to compare it to before. Mm. The model I would have had about being married would have been doing things as an able-bodied person. So I had to learn to do things as somebody without hands. And what I found very quickly is that this world is not designed for people without hands. So I can look at situations now and through experience know straight away if I can deal with it. I could also look at a situation and say, I know I can deal with it, I'm not sure how, and then I'll let the idea sit with me and a solution will come to me. Or I can look at a situation and say, I can't deal with that at all, and ask for help. Mm. So it was a challenge trying to do things without hands, which had previously done before with hands.
Because you have no right arm and you do have a left arm down to the elbow with nerve endings. Uh-huh. Is that correct?
Well, what I have, the right arm, it was amputated above the elbow. Mm-hmm. The left arm was amputated mid-forearm. So what I have on the right-hand side is a mechanical hand, which at first glance looks like a hand. Mm-hmm. On the left side, I would wear a steel hook. So it usually gets stares from people. But I try to do things as naturally as possible. But it's quite funny. Whenever I would meet people for the first time, I would reach out my plastic hand to shake hands with them. And often people are comfortable enough with it and they would shake my hand. Sometimes I get an interesting reaction, let's say. And I remember one time reaching out to shake somebody's hand at a New Year's Eve party, and the man saw it was plastic, leapt back and had a look of shock on his face. Then a smug look came over his face and I thought, I know what he's going to do. He's going to shake the left one. Sure enough, he smiled and reached out to shake the left one. So it reached the hook up at this point. And then the look of surprise that came over his face was nothing ordinary.
That's funny. I remember being in my grandmother's house years ago and she had a friend that had a hook. And it is quite disarming when you see it first.
It certainly is.
I believe that you weren't actually scheduled to be on duty that day, the 28th of September 1981. Is that right?
Well, the way it was, was, I think, meant to be inside that day, but somebody else needed to be working on files and had asked could they stay in. So I was actually out on mobile patrol. So it was a regular turn of duty.
It's just, I mean, it seems like so long ago, but when you actually look at it, 1981, you know, it wasn't at all. Did you return to work with the RUC after this?
No, I remained on sick leave for the next 2 years. Jack Herman, who was the chief constable at the time, had said to me, Michael, don't worry about a job. But as I lay in the hospital bed listening to those words, I thought, he didn't say what job. So I knew I couldn't be an effective police officer without hands. I wouldn't get the practical experience that I needed to advance. So I'd resigned myself at that point that my career in the police was over.
So what did you do?
Well, when I was on the sick, I had been out to the University of Ulster with a psychologist, a health psychologist who I'd met, and we had spoken about the various courses I could do. I'd left school with two O-levels, so I didn't actually rate myself academically. But Stuart Lewis, who was the prof of psychology applied to medicine, had applied a few psychological tests to me, which suggested that I was intelligent enough to go to university. So we spoke to the staff at what was then the Ulster Polytechnic, and they said, yes, we'd be happy to have you. But it's too late to apply for the incoming year, which would have been 1982. So I did two A-levels in a year and passed them.
Right, not good for you.
Not great grades, mind you, but passed
them
nevertheless. So I went off to university then. It was the poly to study social sciences. So there was a foundation year that I studied first of all, and then I took the psychology option at the end of that. Now, I'd started off thinking, well, if I get a pass degree at the end of this, I'll be happy. But at the end of year one, I was told by the senior course tutor that I had the best student profile. Now, I didn't actually know what that meant until I asked somebody, and they said, that means you were the top student. And I thought, what? So I couldn't believe that. But I started then to think, well, if I could do that with a bit of effort in year one, it's possible then that I could do very well with a psychology degree. Mm. So I started to set myself goals of getting good marks, and I was getting good marks, and I thought, well, perhaps I could get a first class honours. Now, this was thinking beyond the pale for me. So I set that as a goal and started working towards it and recognising what I had to do to get myself there. So I started with the end in mind and then worked back to the small goals. And it actually went back to, at the end of a day, typing up the lecture notes for that day, that weekend, reading over the lecture notes at the end of the term, reading over the term's lecture notes. So having that ingrained, which meant that whenever...
How did you cope with that? Sorry for interrupting. How did you cope with that with your injuries?
Well, what I did, I tried writing the lecture notes by hand, and then that night I had to type them up when it was still fresh. Mm. And these were the days, well, the early days of word processing. And I eventually, in second year, I think it was, I bought an Apple IIe computer with 36K of memory. Now, we're talking about megabytes and terabytes of memory and things now, but this was like 64K of memory, and to me this was state of the art. In fact, it was, and it was about £1,500 then for this computer and monitor, and it couldn't really do that much, but there was a simple word processing package on it which made a huge difference to me.
Well, you qualified in 99 and, you know, since then you've become one of the most well-regarded and highly sought-after therapists. You practice a particular form of trauma therapy, which you credit with your own recovery. Tell me about the experience with EMDR.
Yes, well, EMDR stands for Eye Movement Desensitization and Reprocessing. And it's a very effective psychological therapy that was really discovered by accident in 1987 by Dr. Francine Shapiro in the United States. And she found that as she had some disturbing thoughts in her mind, that as her eyes were moving spontaneously from side to side while thinking about this, the thoughts seemed to lose their impact. And from that, she developed this therapy, Eye Movement Desensitization and Reprocessing. So I had the opportunity of training in this in the late 1990s. And as part of the training and the therapy, it's required that the person undergoes it as the therapist, but also as the client. So when I checked with the trainer if he was happy that I could work in the incident where I lost my arms, he said, yeah, go for it. Now, Roger Solomon, who was the trainer, was from the United States and had worked with police officers there and would continue to do so in different parts of the world. So I was able to work on that particular memory. And the nature of EMDR is that it links into the way the memory is stored in the brain. And with traumatic memories, whether they be the big T traumas such as that, or even small T traumas where somebody is told regularly they're stupid, they're useless, they're thick, then they develop that negative self-belief. There'll usually be an image that goes with that, a picture that represents the worst part of it. There will be a negative self-belief that goes with it. And in my case, it's I'm a failure because losing my arms, this was another thing I'd failed at in my life because I'd left school with two levels and didn't actually believe in myself. Mm. The emotion for me was a sadness, but also a knot in my stomach. And as we linked into the memory, I had an image of the severed arm. I had that negative self-belief, I'm a failure, a certain sense of sadness and the feeling in my stomach. But as the therapist who was working with me asked me just to track her fingers back and forward with my eyes, the image started to fade and another image came up of the explosion outside the vehicle, and that was fine. Then the sadness seemed to disappear, and then I was left with this knot in my stomach. And as I focused on that, then I felt something move up through my body, and next thing, tears started to stream down my cheeks. And they kept going. And I remembered the last time I'd cried those same tears. And that was 17 years previously when I was in hospital. And at that time, I was in traction. My leg was in a Thomas splint, which was strung up with weights trying to pull the leg down so that the femur would knit. And there was an infection in my leg, so I was at risk of losing it. The nurse who was in with me at that time was doing a dressing to try and reduce the infection on the leg. The swelling had gone down in what was left of my arms. The bandages had fallen off. And at that time, about 2.5 weeks after the injury, I could see the extent of my injuries and the tears started to stream down my cheeks as I cried. But the nurse who was with me then covered up my leg and just held me in a very maternal way. And as a little boy, when I'd hurt myself, my mummy had held me, and I stopped crying because big boys don't cry. And when mommy soothes you, you stop crying. So those tears became locked in at that stage. And it was only 17 years later when I was experiencing EMDR, it helped unlock that emotion.
What had
that was
been there for 17
there.
Years. It's yeah. Pretty incredible. Have you worked with patients whose experience of trauma came from involvement with paramilitary groups, you know, something similar to what happened to yourself?
In terms of the psychological work that I've done, I've tended to focus on people who had been involved with the security forces, police officers and military. But I've also worked with firefighters as well who have had the experience of the troubles. I have had contact with people who have been involved in paramilitary groups, but not in a therapeutic sense or direct therapeutic sense, and that was through the Glencree Centre for Reconciliation.
Okay, well, there's a lot of texts of support coming in for you. Michael is awe-inspiring. He's a wonderful man. May God bless him always. We really have little to complain about. That comes in from Geraldine. That man is amazing, a real example of human endeavour. Does he know the person who carried out the attack, or has he met him, or what does he think of him or them?
That's actually quite a good question, because I never actually met the person who did it, but I was told there were seven people involved who were arrested afterwards, but nobody actually went to jail for it, apparently.
Are you still angry about what happened to you?
No, that's the thing. And I had an opportunity actually on the BBC Two programme Facing the Truth a number of years ago, where Archbishop Desmond Tutu had people sitting across a table and telling their stories. And what the idea of this was that somebody who had been injured or hurt in some way in the Troubles then would have spoken to the person who had carried it out. I had been invited initially to meet somebody who had brought the rocket-propelled grenades into Belfast, and I said I would meet with this person. So I was prepared to do this on camera, but then when it got closer to the time, I was told this person had pulled out, and I was offered to meet somebody else, which said, yes, not a problem.
God, and how did that make you feel? Being so close to it mm-hmm. and then it being...
I was okay about that. I was offered to meet somebody else. I said, yes, I'm happy to do that. And then that person pulled out. And then on the day itself, I was told that person had pulled out, would I meet somebody else? Yeah, I said, bring them on. So at that stage, it was somebody who had been involved in a totally different incident, who had shot dead two members of the Ulster Defence Regiment. But it was interesting sitting across the table hearing that man's story, and that man was called Tommy McChrystal. We met there as individuals. He came from a different political viewpoint to me, and I heard his story and he heard mine. We both had mutual respect for each other's point of view. And at the end of it, one of the things I said to him was, if I had had the experiences you had growing up, I may have gone the same way as you. And Desmond Tutu was quite shocked by that, to hear that coming from me. And in fact, I think I was probably quite shocked to hear it coming from me as well. But the two of us were able to speak, and we were comfortable with that. But interestingly, I'd mentioned about being involved with Glenn Cree. They had arranged a trip to South Africa, and part of the trip was being out in the bush with members of, or let's what they called the ex-combatants group. And in the group, there was a chap who had been involved in the prisons as a prison officer, myself as an ex-police officer. There were two former members of the IRA and two former members of the Ulster Volunteer Force, the Loyalist Paramilitary Group. And we were expected then just to go and survive in the bush with a guide and rely on each other for our survival. So it was no sort of planned thing that we'll build bridges and do this, that and the other thing. It was just really survival as part of the ecology of the wilderness. And as a result of that, I was then keeping a fire lit at night so that wild animals wouldn't come in and eat somebody. So I was keeping guys who had been the IRA alive and guys who had been the UVF alive. And conversely, they were keeping me alive. So
I mean, who would have thought that you would be in a situation like that? It's pretty incredible.
It certainly is. And,
I'd actually love to hear more about it. Unfortunately, we're running out of time, Michael. I know that you do have courses, not just with trauma victims, but also personal development work as well. And if anyone wants to find out about your courses, it's michaelpatterson.com. And it's Dr. Michael Patterson, and that's just with one T. Isn't that right? DrMichaelPatterson.com.
That's correct, yes.
And I'm really sorry to have to cut you off there. It's been so interesting. The feedback here on through text has been phenomenal. And thank you for sharing your story. And wish you all the best, Hazel. And four children. Right. Listen, well done, Michael. Thanks very much for talking to us. Back after
this. Thanks, Catherine.